listening to Ruining It for Everyone with your hosts Maggie McPhee and Christopher Harrington. Tonight's episode, Shake Your Make Affair with Kristen C. Martin and John Foster. This episode is sponsored by Adobe Production Premium. We haven't recorded in a really long time.
I know.
Yeah. That's
how long has it been?
Too damned long.
Forgive me, Foster, for I have sinned. It has been 4 weeks since my last podcast.
Yeah, I think it's probably been, yeah, three or four weeks. Yeah.
You guys, you know, you're only 4 weeks and I have a different problem.
Uh-oh. Oh, yeah, that's right. You've got like 36 billion episodes that aren't yet live.
I know. I'm overwhelmed by the make is what's happening.
Oh.
You know, there's sometimes when you get so many projects that you don't know which one to actually do or finish or start because there's just too many.
Right. It's the diner menu problem, right? There's just too much and it all becomes overwhelming and daunting.
Yeah, it's like, you know, you go into Starbucks and they have coffee and you go into Pete's and they've got Major Dickinson's
coffee.
And French and no, they've got 37 choices. And so, like, what do you want? I don't know. It's like, it's a daunting experience.
The answer is always Major Dickinson's.
That's true. That's a very good choice. You know, and the thing with the make is that, you know, if you go to a maker fair, which I know you guys just went to one, and we had one here 6 months ago, you walk away from it and you're instantly, what the hell do I do now?
Well, you're energized, though, too. I mean, it's so inspirational. It's so fantastic. You know, you've got all these people there, and it's a gigantic crowd. And that's actually quite daunting for me as well. I don't do well in large crowds, especially large crowds that involve very small children. And I tried to push through it all, but I wound up not getting there early enough. Very similar to what OBF is these days, which is just too fucking crowded. And I wound up having a really lovely time. But wow, it would have been really nice if I went maybe about 3 hours earlier. It was also raining as well. So Everyone was on the inside, you know, in the inside near the Science and Technology Center versus outside in daylight or under the tents or what have you.
Well, ours was a mini maker fair, so it only ran for 4 hours.
Oh.
So it was all kids all the time. Yeah.
It was the Charlie Brown Christmas tree of maker fairs.
No, but it was actually, we had a lot. We had about 2,000, maybe more than 2,000 people come through.
Wow.
So, you know, mini maker fairs are kind of like beta testing maker fairs for your area. And I think we proved pretty good. But man, I have never talked to so many 10 and 12 year olds. It's one right after the other. It's like, so what's this one? What's this one? What's this one? How long did it take to make that? But it was great. I mean, I tried to, you know, to answer all their questions, not talk down to them.
The things that the 12-year-olds are talking about are the exact same things that the 12-year-olds were talking about when the 80s computers were around. You know,
yeah,
the TRS-80s, the Apple IIs, the Commodore 64s. And, you know, the thing with 12-year-olds is that they have an endless amount of time.
Right. Yeah, they don't have much homework. They don't have day jobs.
I'm gonna respectfully disagree on that. They don't have a lot of time. So many kids are overscheduled.
Well, it depends on what it is, right? I mean, they're scheduled, but they're scheduled a lot to do with their parents.
Yeah.
You know, their parents have to. You know, they want to put them in sports and they want to put them in study groups and play groups and this and that and the other thing. And how much of that is the kids want and how much of that is the parents sort of need to keep the child occupied?
Well, I think there's a good mix of both, but you know, there's also a lot dictated by education, schooling, as far as that it takes up a lot of time. And there's also a lot of competition, I think, for a kid's attention.
Yeah. Oh, just in general, like television versus video games,
yeah,
versus internet versus,
right,
sure.
Video games, online, peer group, everything.
I still think maybe it's true, though, that you know, that 10 to 12-year-old age, you may not have a lot of time, but the time you do have, you aren't so, I don't know, what's the word? You're not so inured towards wasting a bit of it.
You have an interest that's there. I mean, one of the things that I helped somebody who was 12 do, I showed him how to do stop-motion animation. And my showing him lasted maybe an hour at the most. And then I didn't see him for 3 weeks and came back to visit, and 3 weeks later, there was something like 20 minutes of animation.
Wow.
And that's the cool thing, too, is that I'm sure, like, from what John's done and Maggie's done, kids take it and they run with it. And it's like, sometimes we're so jaded, it might be like, okay, well, maybe when I have time, I'll get to it. But that's the coolest thing when you see, you know, where they've taken it with their own imagination and skills.
I think you touched on a really good point, which is, as adults, we tend to find reasons to not do something, like, oh, I'm just too tired, I don't want to do it right now, I'll procrastinate and I'll put it off, or the amount of things I have to get done are so large and so daunting that I can't get them done. Whereas if you're a kid, if you're into something, if something ignites that spark, you will find every excuse to do it. And I think that's a fundamental difference.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that.
I don't know. I ran into a great excuse the other day for stopping something, which was, I found out that Eagle has a limit of 10 centimeters by 7 centimeters, and I could not get around that easily. So I said, well, I'm just going to stop learning this tool.
Well, that's actually, I wouldn't disagree with that, though. I mean, you know. I mean, yeah, the Eagle limitation is a bit of a pain in the ass, but so, you know, I don't disagree with you there. But please go move on to another tool.
Oh, no, I did. And so that started the whole, let's see, I'm going to go down the rabbit hole of 5 hours learning about every other tool.
Right.
From KiCad to, I don't know, there's seven of them, and I managed to figure it out down to two.
Yeah, there's a lot of, as the MakerBot people say, there are a lot of hammers out there.
Right.
There's a lot of hammers out there. But, you know, that's the thing. I was undaunted by this because I do need to have a board layout system that I like. And if I don't like it, and I was kind of not liking Eagle because it feels like the 80s. Mm. From a CAD point of view, that's fine, but I'm not a CAD person. I live in Illustrator and design tools that are more modern.
Yeah.
It's kind of like with the, you know, with audio editing programs, some people are used to, or video editing, some people are used to a certain paradigm and some people don't come from that world. And it's like, you know, as if you threw them into a foreign culture and just said, here, you're on your own. You have to use what's right for the way you work.
Exactly. You know, and I did find success. I mean, I did a board layout for my MicMeet project, and I did another board layout for the L-Wire sequencer that I did. You know, and it's fine as long as you are in the confines of those centimeters. But once you get bigger than that, then tough luck.
You'd think that the programs would offer arbitrarily large boards as a canvas. That just seems logical to me.
Yeah, in Eagle's case, they want to charge for, you know, if you want to make larger boards.
Okay, that's their sort of freemium model, I suppose.
Yeah.
And I thought that, you know, I'm like, oh, maybe I thought it could just be area, right? So it can't be bigger than these dimensions, which would work for me because I'll make it tall and long.
Right.
John, already thinking outside of the box.
Actually, and yet still within the confines of the rectangle.
Of the box, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it's like this box can be tall and not so wide, and that's perfect. And, you know, I'll use a cable tie to fix the other problem.
Right. This box is 1 centimeter wide and 100 centimeters long.
Perfect. Ship it.
Yeah, actually, that would work really well. And you know, I'm thinking about that. There's no really good way of getting circuit boards made out of flexi material to custom made. We don't have that option yet. And that would actually be an interesting circuit board. 1 centimeter wide, 100 centimeters long. Yeah, I could make something out of that.
That's the spirit of making right there.
Well, that was one of the other things that I saw in great abundance, which was the wearable LED electro fabric thing. They had all sorts of little microcontrollers with either predefined or programmable LEDs on them. And which I thought was kind of fascinating because before they were always fairly bulky, but now they're thin enough to be worn as if they were normal clothing.
It's amazing what surface mount chips will do for you, and that 1 centimeter wide circuit board.
Right. Yeah.
Well, it's also a matter of people wanting that sort of thing, you know, and some, if you want it, someone will eventually produce something you can do it with.
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, the design has, you've seen the iterations over the years, you know, first they were bulky and weird and they had wires all over the place and they were very, you know, not even steampunk, but they were golden age of wireless type of crazy making. And then they got smaller and more refined and smaller and more refined. And now, you know, now we're actually seeing full on electronic gear by like Burton or whomever, who will make these snowboard jackets that you can program your you know, iPod with, which is kind of cool. You know, it's kind of a natural extension of the whole idea. And that's, you know, that's pretty wild that that sort of thing is going mainstream.
I think there's a lot of things at the Maker Faire that maybe a few years back you would have been surprised that look like a solution in search of a problem, but that actually has practical applications now because it's enough time and has gone by and people have miniaturized things or made them more mainstream and more affordable.
Well, look at the 3D printers, for example. I would say 3/4 of the outside area of the New York Maker Faire seem to be dominated by 3D printers.
Wow.
And there's a dozen different kinds.
Yeah. And to the point where I can't even keep them all straight anymore. At first, we had the MakerBot, and that was the big thing that was, you know, fairly hyped because you could make it yourself, and it was relatively inexpensive, and it still had a fairly, you know, at the time anyway, it had a very high quality product. And of course,
right. Whereas the Prusa, the Mendels, and stuff, you had to like buy all the little parts yourself, and or get somebody to print some stuff, and then twiddle it together and set. Yeah. Whereas the MakerBot, it was like, all right, here's a kit.
Right. Yeah. It seemed to strike that really nice balance between completely making it yourself and just assembling it. You know, having to do all the work in finding out how to make it versus just like, okay, here's all the parts, piece it together yourself, and Bob's your uncle.
But things have changed in the last 3 years since that version, since the MakerBot came out. One of the things is that there's a huge support system in everything, people selling parts on eBay to businesses that have popped up to support things like stepper motors and the different versions of the electronics and the stepper drivers and the specific parts for it. I mean, some of these parts are really weird and specific, and you couldn't just order 5 of them in the past. You had to order 100 of them. Well, now, now it's really easy to get that, the ST-296-7 part.
Right. I need a 7x7x7 piece of glass that's this thick for the bed. You know, it's like, well, you're going to have to find somebody to cut it. Now you can go online and just buy one. It's great to see that popping up. And then the next printer I plan on buying is the PrinterBot, PrinterBot. But there's all these machines out there. You know, there's another one on Kickstarter right now called the InventorBot, which looks really nice because it uses a steel frame. So it's very rigid, which means, you know, less, you know, not no drift, no jitter and things like that. It's really just great to see all this stuff popping up. Like you say, it's just becoming more and more readily available, even though the maker movement is still not a huge thing, but it's starting to get its claws into the mainstream.
Sure. I mean, yeah, we're clearly seeing a faster evolution of these things. And as I said, you know, they're tracking exactly how personal computers tracked back in the day. You know, the Apple One was, you know, a circuit board, and that was basically it. And, you know, the original MakerBot was, you know, a kit, and now we're seeing, you know, readily, you can now buy a 3D printer that, just as you said, is, you know, super solid, it comes already assembled, and it's like, you know, buying an Epson or something.
Right.
And the resolution's higher, and the materials are better, and you know, soon people are going to have these, you know, in their houses next to... Actually, they're probably going to be doing a lot more 3D printing than they are 2D printing. That may be a stretch, at least in the near future. But for example, you know, if I'm not printing out fine art prints of photography, I'm not printing traditional 2D stuff. But I would print tiny three-dimensional objects all day long because I'm always needing some fastener that, you know, if I could just have a piece that kind of was shaped like this or kind of did this thing, I could draw that in a CAD program, spit it out on my 3D printer, and bam, have it in a couple of hours.
Or you spent all day mucking with the 3D
Well, there's that too.
The dark downside of it.
3D printing does have a very dark side. And one of those dark sides is the fact that you have to know the tool.
Right.
And knowing the tool isn't enough. You've got to know the tool to be able to get the things that you want to have.
It's not half the battle. I printed a Iron Man arc reactor for the fair, and I put LEDs and lit it up and stuff.
Yes,
and
you did.
Wow. It was completely designed in SketchUp.
Oh,
unbelievably.
Wow.
And it was lovely.
If you look at this model, you look at the model in SketchUp, it will blow your mind that some guy did this in SketchUp. But it takes a lot of patience, obviously, probably. But it's possible. It's not easy anymore. But, you know, as time goes on, these things will come more. I'm not saying that, you know, everyone will have a 3D printer sitting in the kitchen, because the same way we don't have a computer sitting in the office, you know, or a computer's in your phone, it's in your living room, it's in your TV. I think over time, I mean, it's going to be many years, but this will become more and more ubiquitous.
Yeah, and right now it's all about that your tolerance for the fiddly.
Right.
Right.
And, you know, as it becomes more democratized and there's less pieces to the tool chain or whatever, I think that more people, you know, would jump on board and feel it was part of their everyday life. But just right now, I think it really is limited to more people who are tinkerers or who really have a tolerance for that thing.
I think we're still at the possible stage. You know, we've gone from this is impossible to this is possible versus this is easy or this is ubiquitous or what have you. It's that era where, you know, there's the handful of people, and by handful, obviously, it's, you know, several thousand people worldwide, tens of thousands of people worldwide. But they're the ones that are the trailblazers. They're the ones who are interested in tinkering with the new thing in order to get comfortable with it, in order to take it the next step forward.
Right. Well, the good news is that you don't have to have a 3D printer on your desk to take advantage of 3D printing.
That's a good point.
There's enough of them around me that I kind of don't have to have one. You know, there's a MakerBot at Tech Shop. There's a MakerBot.
Oh, I know which one you mean. Yeah.
Noisebridge, and yes. You know, there's that place down in Mountain View that has one. So Tom Mahady has one. So if I wanted something, I could just send him the
he could be your 3D printing service bureau.
Exactly.
Right?
Nice.
Right, or you can send it out to Shapeways and
exactly.
Have it done online.
It's not like we can't get 3D printing, and that's what's exciting. You know. There's a bunch of tools that we can use to do that. A Libre, whatever that thing's called. There's a $100 hobby version that doesn't have a 7x7 limitation. It has a different limitation, but it's great because it pretends to be a solid CAD program. And then there's the other thing, the Autodesk 123D.
Yeah.
And that's a really That doesn't run on a Mac yet. They've promised that it will, but it's a really solid, very useful tool to have.
Yeah, and you know things like, and then if you're on the PC side and on the Mac, I mean, there's Wings 3D and OpenSCAD and all the. There's so many hammers out there. And that's what's great. Another thing about this is that this is not being driven by some company somewhere, which is kind of what is slightly different from the computer revolution. Is everyone had to wait for the, you know, the processor manufacturers to give them something to play with. Whereas now we have people building their own, you know, everything, designing the microcontrollers from the ground up. It's far more in the people's hand than it has ever been.
Well, all the component parts are there already. You know, the manufacturing of the component parts has been advanced for jillions of years. So we're just catching up. We're just catching up because we happen to need this part from bin A, this other part from bin B, this other part from bin C, and bringing them all together. The ultra-precise stepper motors are out there. The ultra-fast, you know, microcontrollers are out there. It's just now we're assembling them now.
And if they're not, someone in China will make it for you.
Right. Oh, well, there's even that as well, right? You know, so if you've got a basic design.
Yeah. I mean, the manufacturing is online waiting for you to say, I need something.
Right. Yeah, and again, you know, that stuff wasn't possible 10, 15 years ago, and it's possible now. It will obviously get cheaper, better, easier over time, but now it's just beginning, but the doors have flung open and almost anything is possible now. It's kind of exciting. I also wanted to talk about LEDs and a little bit more about LEDs. So it seems to me that my Maker Faire in Queens was divided in half between sort of practical models, practical animatronic type models. I shouldn't say in half, in thirds probably. Animatronic models, MakerBot, 3D printer type stuff, or somehow CAD related. So either 3D scanning, that was also a pretty big hit.
Yeah.
You had these sort of three-dimensional styli, which is kind of cool. So you could have a physical model, for example, and use an articulated pen, which you could then basically trace over the surface of the system, and that would actually effectively draw a 3D model inside your CAD program.
Those have been at SIGGRAPH for years.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, but they're incredibly expensive.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They're massively expensive. But again, they're getting cheaper as well over time. Which is
I mean, that's why there was one there, yeah. But yeah, like Kristen said, they've been around, but they've always been very expensive.
Right. And I remember back in the day where, you know, now they're basically doing laser scanning, where they're not even bothering with a pen anymore. They're just doing three-dimensional laser scanning for a 3D image, which is way faster and probably a little bit more accurate as well. That's still pretty expensive though.
There's some pretty amazing tech around that I saw at the, it wasn't the last SIGGRAPH show, but I think 2008, where they had a lot of stuff where it's sort of grown by leaps and bounds. And it looked very expensive though. I don't think it's something you're going to have in your workshop.
Yeah. Brooks Brothers flagship in Manhattan had basically a body scanner where you went in and they made a 3D version of you. You had you on file with them, and whenever you wanted clothing tailored to your measurements, they would just call it up and they would you know, custom create it to that particular model, which is crazy town.
We live in the future and it is awesome.
Totally live in the future.
I was about to go, yeah, that's cool, that's been around. And I'm like, wait a minute, I'm talking about a suit manufacturer. You can walk in and be scanned.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
It doesn't get more mainstream or stodgy or old school than Brooks Brothers, you know?
No.
You know, Brooks Brothers, the outfitter for middle managers, you know? It's, you know, you can't really go wrong with the Brooks Brothers suit. I'm just saying that they're cut not flatteringly. But
they're all so expensive.
Yeah, and they're not, you know, and again, you know, they're not, you know, Versace or Armani or you know, Isaiah or anything like that. But, you know, they're a good suit. They're not a great suit. But yeah, the fact that they decided that they were going to do this body scanning thing was absolutely brilliant.
Well, I mean, we've even seen this come down to like the, what's it called, John? The 1-2-3D catch, the thing for iPhone. You can scan, you know, anything and turn it into a model. That's in people's phones right now, you know?
What's this?
Oh, you haven't done that?
I don't have that app.
It kind of sort of works.
I have the original iPhone. So.
But the fact that it does it on a phone is just phenomenal.
Well, yeah, sure, it's phenomenal, but you have to remember that when the iMac got made in 1998, it was 233 megahertz, and this Mac played video full screen. It had the concept of writing to a DVD, or excuse me, to a CD. Didn't do DVDs for a number of years, but it did that eventually, and, you know, it was this thing. It was all in one box. I mean, you know, we developed things on that. You know, it was good enough to do, you know, millions of papers and laying out books and, you know, on and on. And that was really slow by comparison. And so the thing that's in your pocket is a 1 gigahertz dual or quad processor thing, which is way more powerful than that iMac ever was. And yet, most of the time, it's that power is underutilized.
Sure,
and so it's not a surprise that there can be a concept of photographic 3D scanning. That doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, here's a better comparison. Back in the day when I was making panoramas for QuickTime VR, we had to go using a 17 millimeter lens, shot on film. The film went to a scanner. What was that called? The photo process where you got a disc, photo CD. So you got a
photo CD.
You got a photo CD made of 2K images, and then those got stitched together, and it took a Quadra 950 16 hours to do the stitch. And that was based on mathematical, the fact that you had, you know, nearly perfect aiming on your camera.
Right.
And it was totally level.
Yeah, you had to have a ball head with all the precise measurements and all that sort of thing. It was really daunting. You wound up purchasing QuickTime VR specific rigs in order to do that.
Exactly.
Because off the shelf, you know, photographic gear was not precise enough to deal with that.
And so then when PowerPC came along, so keep in mind, it's not that much faster, but it's PowerPC. It took the PowerPC 45 minutes to do that stitch. Well, I did a panorama the other night, just showing it off, like, here's the panorama. Click, 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 put, paste, put on Twitter. Right?
All in real time.
All in real time. No, you know, it became part of the conversation, not this ordeal that, you know, we had to charge $800 to do.
Right. Yeah. It's just totally mind-blowing that...
Right, exactly. That's the point I'm making, is that it's like these things we've conceptualized are not only available, they are so available that they're in your pocket, you know, to some degree.
Right.
I mean, clearly this thing doesn't do as well as a laser scanner or the manual, can't remember what you call it, photo model creation, but I mean, it's there.
So Maggie, can you describe how that works exactly? Do you know what it does? Because I'm not familiar with the app at all.
So it's called 1-2-3D Catch. It's an Adobe thing. Basically, what you do is you take a series of pictures of something, mm-hmm. You know, around the subject, over the subject, in a certain way.
Oh, very much like a VR. You.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But you just take them with your phone, and then it uploads it to their 1-2-3D servers, which turns it into a 3D model and sends it back to you.
Oh, that's pretty cool. So it's specifically for an object versus like a panorama, having like a three-dimensional panorama or something.
Right. It's for an object.
I get it. That's pretty cool.
But in a way, I think that what all we're talking about really is what makes the maker movement work, is that we've had these ideas of stuff, but now all these tools are just lying at our feet waiting, you know, they're waiting for us to just pick up and use, which is just amazing. I mean, you know, the fact that, you know, John, you've been using your Raspberry Pi, doing some stuff with that recently, right?
Yeah, I have a hate relationship with that thing right now.
Well, me too. I hated mine the moment I got it because it wouldn't boot for the first three cards.
Oh no!
But its very existence is kind of awesome, you know. Just the fact that some company, well, you know, I don't know how these guys are doing it. I know they're getting money from the university and stuff, but it just seems,
it's interesting in that you take salaries out, you take overhead out, you take the need for insurance and taxes and paying for people's lives, you take that out of the equation,
right.
And of course you can make a $35 computer, right? As long as somebody's paying their existence in their way, then they can do that. And yeah, the foundation might get a little bit of a kickback for each one, which then powers them to do talks and go to places and all that kind of stuff. But that's a stupid existence.
Well, that's the kind of thing. Yeah, it's kind of like, all right, the voodoo part of this is, what do you do after you're done, you know? So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, at least for them, the good thing is it's been popular, but how many do they need to make and sell to make this worth somebody's while?
Well, I was puzzled by the Raspberry Pi concept. I mean, it just seemed like, okay, this is a nano Linux machine.
Well, the idea is, I think the foundation of this is that they wanted something for education. They wanted something so that it was so cheap that you could basically not think about having to think about where the money came from to use it. Or to deploy it. It's kind of like the one laptop per child concept. A great concept, but kind of an undoable thing. I mean, you're basically making these little tiny laptops that cost $100. Well, they don't cost $100 because you've borrowed money to go develop them, and you've relied on foundations and the goodwill of people to do this. And so here's the thing. If in fact the Raspberry Pi was a tool for education, there would be a VGA port on it. And here's why. Because there's a zillion of those dumb CRTs that are in landfills that are going the way of the dodo, and there's no reason why we can't keep using that stuff. Also, look at the idea of all the 17 and 15 inch and nearly always being discarded LCDs, because there's a better one that the designer decides that they have to have, right? So, you know, the recycle centers are full of these things. So let's utilize those parts. You know, if we're absolutely relying on the idea of leveraging free, then let's leverage free for real.
Sure. I mean, that's one of the things that really bothers me, I think, now about a lot of, you know, electronic components, you know, computer gear, etc. We've now arrived at a space where, for the most part, we have machines that are pretty much as fast as they need to be for 99% of usage. And yet, every 2 years or whatever, we get a new one. And the old one is still working. It may not be as fast as the new one, certainly, but it can do something. And in general, it winds up in a landfill. And why is this suddenly an obsolete item when it can be repurposed and reused? You know, the Mac Pros cost, you know, $3,000 or $4,000 when you buy them new. And if you're going to get a new one 4 years later, well, that's still, you know, it's still a huge beefy machine that is plenty capable, that you're just going to have it collect dust in the corner somewhere. That doesn't make any sense.
Well,
I think, you know, I think that some of that stuff is being reused, but, you know, you always have the cold reality of like logistics in, you know, moving giant pallets of, you know, outdated machines somewhere from one place to another. I mean, there's a lot of people who are well-intentioned that come up with these things like for education, but then there's someone has to make it happen.
Right.
And they get to, I've heard of schools going, no, please don't send us any more computers. You know, those we have, they're not great, but they work. And someone set them up. Someone spent the time with them. You want to bring us a whole pallet full of stuff that we're going to have to bring somebody in to do, you know? So, I mean, there's two sides to it. And how if we're constantly, you know, buying new machines, even at a rate where these machines are already, like you say, good for 99% of what we want to do, how long can we repurpose those out when they go, well, we've already got machines that are doing exactly what we need to do, you know?
Right.
They'll just be stacking up on the doorstep.
Oh, sure.
And the problem is us.
Well, and I wasn't really necessarily thinking of it on an institutional level, because obviously on an institutional level, you have to deal with things like infrastructure, like what you pointed out. You know, the computers, the situation that they have is currently working, and it's currently well-maintained, or at least maintained in scare quotes. And any change to that system is going to cause a ripple effect. It's going to cause more money to be required, right? So you're going to need, you know, staff to train, you're going to need people to bring it in, you're going to need to take people to set it up, and all that jazz. But, you know, even for like a home, for example, I have a G5 sitting in the corner, and it's a perfectly capable machine, except that the more recent software that I have to be on because of my work no longer runs on that. And
it's like an AOL address. Yeah, you could use it, but
but that's the thing, you know, for a lot of my purposes, the G5 was perfectly fine.
I still use my G5 for audio stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, if during this conversation, if anyone does have any Mac Pros they want to give away, I'll happily take them.
She'll take them off your hands.
Yeah, I got 5 silver boxes. I'll take more.
Well, for me, though, it's also the, okay, well, I could repurpose this gigantic G5, but it's also a gigantic power sink. You know, it's got like a 500-watt power supply in it or something ridiculous.
It'll heat the room pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, my Mac Pro that I've got now, which is the new one, and not the new old one, but the old new one,
2010?
Yes.
Yeah. I had that one at work.
Right. And yeah, it's a hexa-core, and it's got, you know, all of the drives in it. But more importantly, I've got gigantic monitors, including one giganter monitor, thanks to Maggie. And it's 8,000 degrees in this room.
That's it. We've solved it. We don't give all these machines to schools for computers. Give it to them for heating.
Yes, exactly. Bring them all to Alaska or wherever.
Gather around the G5, kiddies.
Yeah, you know, right. it's your portable space heater.
Put Mathematica on it and just set it to, you know, do Fibonacci numbers forever.
Oh, speaking of Fibonacci numbers, do any of you follow Vihart on YouTube?
Oh, the hexaflexagons?
This is the month of the hexaflexagon.
Oh, I love Vihart so much. Vi, please marry me.
I heart her in such big ways. Oh my goodness. So if folks at home, if you haven't heard of this lovely, lovely woman who is very much into the mathematics and the doodling, you really owe it to yourself to check her out on the YouTube. Vihart, V-I, heart as in, you know, the thing that pumps your blood.
Or H-A-R-T, yeah.
Yeah.
Vihart.com, too.
Oh, right. Cool. Oh, wait, it's H-A-R-T or E-A-R-T?
Yeah.
A-R-T. A-R-T. Oh, okay. Because I can't remember how to spell things. So yes, H-A-R-T, not H-E-A-R-T. Yeah, it's absolutely fantastic. I've watched probably all of her videos, and she's got quite a few. This month, she decided that she was going to go into the wacky world of hexaflexagons, which really comes down to taking a strip of paper, folding it up into a bunch of triangles, and then sort of folding that into a hexagon, then taping one side, and then realizing that what seems to be a flat two-sided object actually has more than two sides.
And there's if you go to madartlab.com, we did a post on it as well. She is I'm not into math. I'm really bad at math. I don't drive. I'm not really into cars, but I love Vihart, and I will watch these math videos over and over and over. And I love, like, just like I love Top Gear.
Right.
You know, I don't drive, but I love watching that show.
Well, because, you know, driving fun exotic cars is you know, vicariously is the closest most people will be able to come.
You can appreciate it without having to take part. Yeah.
Exactly.
Right, and it's a beautifully shot show. So.
Right. And that's the thing. I really need to get Vihart HD equipment. Does anyone know where she is? Because we can just send that shit to her. I'm serious. Because, I mean, I'm sure I've got a 1080p camera that is, you know, on the disposable level webcam or something like that. I could send it to her and be like, hey, record with this.
You have a VR6 or something, right?
That's a good question. I don't know what I've got going on.
I mean, you know, there's the HD Flip, there's a Kodak, mm-hmm. the VRs, there's enough HD cameras around between all of us that we should be able to send one to her.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, she should be able to get, do you know where she works? She works at the Khan Academy.
Yeah.
Salman Khan's nonprofit.
Yeah. She should be able to have the equipment.
I think that part of the charm of the videos is the fact that they are such lo-fi kind of things.
But I've got a 30-inch monitor.
Well, you watch it in a little window.
See,
you
know, 280p is not good enough.
It's kind of like, you know.
Well, she's like the mathematics Felicia Day. You know, all the little geek boys really dig her because she's truly passionate about what she's doing, and it makes this thing that's kind of geeky, maybe a little bit inaccessible, very accessible and exciting and fun.
Well, she also does it in stories too. It's always right. A little story. Go ahead, John. Sorry.
And everyone loves stories. One thing I wanted to get to was the Atari Punk console as well. When last time Maggie and I saw each other,
I'll hold mine up to the microphone. See, this is mine that's finished. Actually, I could plug it in really quick. It's kind of cool.
Cool.
Oh yeah. Mine's totally finished too. I'm plugging it in right now.
Yeah.
Hold on. I'm gonna plug mine in. I'll be right back. Here, just here. I'm gonna go
right
do
on,
that.
Right on.
Moving across the room.
Stand by.
Mine is, my Atari Funk console is still sitting in a
pouch. In the original pouch.
I opened the pouch. Now I opened the pouch.
You mean it's no longer new in box?
Mint in package.
Uh-oh, I hear noise.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, wrong.
Here we go.
Wrong power supply. I made it so that it worked in a wall wart.
Yeah.
I just have the wrong one. So let's make sure this one is the right one. Nope, that's not it either.
It's the butt face people from South Park.
Yeah, so I built this. This one's kind of cool. I built it as a stereo unit. So there's two of them in cool. The same thing.
Oh, cool.
And so you make two different noises.
Right. Yeah, it sounded exactly like it. The combat cartridge that came on the 2600.
Yeah, exactly.
And you can modulate the sounds and all that, so you can kind of... That's wild.
Yeah, there's two dials on it.
Country and Western.
And Western, exactly. That channel's not working for some stupid reason.
Back to fries.
Back to mono.
Back to mono.
Back to virtual fries.
No.
Anyway, so then, nice. That's the demo, though. Sorry that took so long. It's like, I did this... With the idea of, I put a, you know, make a wall wart, right? Put it in a wall wart so that it just does its thing. Oh, it's being overpowered. That's what's going on. Put it in a, you know, have it so that it doesn't need just a 9-volt or 5 volts or whatever. But then I lost the wall wart that I made for it.
Oh, no.
Oh, you know what? If they still have them, Mac Sales was selling the little tiny iPhone power adapters, the USB ones. Yeah. About like 10 of them for like $3 a piece or something.
Cool.
So I'm going to use it for things like, you know, plug-in things.
How many watts are those, by the way? Do they draw fewer watts than the iPad version? Because the iPad's like a 15?
10 watts is the iPad.
Oh, okay.
And the iPhone is limited to whatever USB will let it do, which is either 500 milliamps or 1 amp total.
Ew.
Right.
But that spec is in the 1 amp spec is in question.
Well, yeah, because it's outside of the USB spec. It's technically cheating.
Right. Well, it's what they're doing. They're basically overpowering the USB ports on every Mac.
Right.
Well, they made it to do it. The whole USB power thing just shows you how crufty USB really is.
That's a very good point.
We should have moved on from USB within 3 years of USB 2 being out. Yet manufacturers said, no, this is the standard. We're going to do this. And it's been around for way longer than it should have been. I mean, we should be on USB. We should have speeds of ludicrous speeds on this bus by now.
But it's also so incredibly cheap and easy to make. I mean, it's four fecking wires that are, you know, entirely unshielded, entirely, you know, wacky. And I imagine that if you make it any more complex, suddenly, you know, manufacturing costs go up, etc. I mean, it's...
Part of it is that USB, half of the wires are power. So it's either 3.3 volts or 5 volts. And then the other one is transmit and receive, but it's differential transmit and receive. So you basically can run it for fairly long without having it be shielded.
Right.
And the electrical limitation is 15 feet, although you can push it if you have better wire.
Good to know.
Yeah.
But the biggest problem is that, you know, USB was made for keyboards. It was not made for putting a hard drive onto it.
Right.
The fact that 90% of the external hard drives that are being sold in the world are powered by USB 2 is tragic, because, you know, people are like, well, why does it take so long? Because it's USB 2. Well, can it go any faster? No, 480 megabits is as fast as it goes.
And it never goes that fast.
No, and it never goes that fast. You know, and you're lucky to get half of that speed because of everything.
Right. And that's why the USB 3 connectors, you know, are different, because of the limitations of that. It's like they're trying to basically hack on the other end to make up for the little lacking. Oh. I totally agree with you on this.
But they still, you know, they also don't really correct the fundamental problems of the USB to begin with, which is, you know, it's dumb, it's not isochronous. There's so much wrong with it.
I think it's great for like little cell phones and crap like that. Sure, you know, that's fine.
Well, but that's what it was. That's what it was made for.
Right.
I mean,
right.
The idea of basing basing a scanner on USB. You know, my old scanners prior to USB, I had a FireWire scanner, for example, that was 7 times faster than the USB scanner.
Sure.
And another scanner that, you know, prior to that, we had a SCSI scanner, and that thing was just as fast as it could go.
Right.
Although I never want to troubleshoot a SCSI bus ever again.
No, I'm quite done with that.
Yeah, please don't bring that up. Nightmarish. The stuff of nightmares.
I'm totally with you, John. I think USB has been dead for so long, but it's just been drug along.
Well, you know, part of the problem is that the chip, the part to make it go, is like 35 cents.
Right.
Yeah, in quantities of one.
Yeah, exactly.
It's quantities of 0.0002 cents in quantities of 1,000.
Right. You know, the thing that lives in a cable that makes a that changes serial to USB to make that cable still cost $1.95. You know, it sits on the circuit board by the connector.
Right.
And there it is, and that will, you know, that drives every single device that doesn't need to have USB on the other side. It just needs to be serial. And, you know, there's enough ROM in the chip so that you can program it to flash it to be, you know, here's my device name. And then the computer can automatically recognize what it is.
Yeah. And then it just, I see chip to chip, it came along, and that just made everything even more cheap, and it's, yeah, I don't know. I don't see an end in sight for it, but I wish it would die.
But I2C and OneWire, those interfaces are perfect for things like toys and keys and in the car that needs to talk, you know, the dashboard needs to talk to the cigarette lighter to see if it's on. You know, that's what that stuff is for. And those buses are very appropriate for when they're for low power devices that need to get statuses or, you know, whatever they need to do.
Yeah, I'm not saying, definitely not saying like take USB off of the computer, because, you know, like you say, you plug that in when you want to talk to your Arduino or whatever. But all this other stuff is just ridiculous. Like you say, hard drives, ludicrous. It's ludicrous.
Exactly.
Well, I think that's also what they were trying to do with, you know, external serial ATA, which is, okay, USB hard drives are ridiculously slow. Here's something that actually approaches the speed limit of the device itself.
Right. And we're going to give it to you with this flaky-ass connector and no power.
Well, that was the whole thing. It was never meant to be.
It was never designed for that. Right.
We were just like, well, we'll just stick it on the outside then. Okay. But, you know, there were plenty of connectors that never supplied power. You know, SCSI was certainly one of them. So, you know, that's not necessarily a foreign thing. But, I think that, you know, the idea of, you know, relegating USB 2 to mice, keyboards, and very low power, low information transfer items, you know, that's fine. That there's no reason to go ludicrous speed on your keyboard, for example. I don't need even better latency on my keyboard. But that said, I think that we do need to think about the additional peripherals that we want to have. I think Thunderbolt's an interesting idea. I think it's too expensive. There's a lot of, you know, weirdness involved, and it's just not as widely adopted as it could be or should be yet to make the prices come down. But I think for high speed, that is fairly ubiquitous, meaning it's a single cable. You just plug it in and it just goes. It just happens. I think it's certainly a good idea.
Yeah, I think we're just kind of going to be stuck with USB 3 for a while, and who knows where we'll go from there.
Yeah.
I mean, I do hope Thunderbolt grabs some traction. I've started to see it on a couple more machines and stuff, but I don't know that it will ever have wide adoption.
Yeah, I mean, it will. I don't. On the Mac side, you know, it's coming out.
It's going to have FireWire adoption, basically.
Right.
We're all going to adopt it, but that doesn't mean anyone else is.
Exactly. And there are going to be PCs with, you know, just like there are PCs with FireWire ports, there are going to be PCs with Thunderbolt ports, and there are today, but they're going to be sitting largely unused, much like USB ports prior to the advent of the iMac.
As long as there's motherboards that have PCI slots or PCIe slots, then there's no reason to have Thunderbolt. Right, because it solves the problem of, okay, I need a RAID card. Okay, plug that in. I need a video card. Okay, plug that in.
But those machines are going away too, though.
Slowly. I mean, as long as there's video editors, there will be motherboards with slots.
The PC side are always going to, they're always going to be able to differentiate themselves by the number of slots they have, the number of RAM slots they have, the number of PCI slots they have. You know, unlike the Macs, which are once again trying to go back to their original form, which is this sealed box, you know, and no expansion whatsoever. It's interesting. I'm not so, well, also, because Thunderbolt is ostensibly external PCI, I don't really see a reason why you couldn't shove a PCI card that had Thunderbolt on it. And maybe it wouldn't go as fast as...
Depends on what you need to do.
Right.
That's fine for a RAID card, but it certainly doesn't work for a video card.
Right, yeah, just not enough bandwidth.
Well, Thunderbolt on video card doesn't work today anyway. There's not enough bandwidth.
Well, you can make it work, but yeah, it's not going to take full advantage of the card. Yeah.
Right. I mean, you're stuck at a single 16-lane, the equivalent of a single 16-lane PCI card. And a lot of modern cards these days, you know, can easily outpace that.
Even the Copper Thunderbolt, you know, even the cards we have right now can completely oversaturate Copper Thunderbolt. So,
right.
But, you know, it just occurred to me, too. I just realized I bought my boss a new Dell Ultrabook, and you know what it had on it? A mini DisplayPort connector.
Wow. Right on.
Which I was like, oh, really?
And not HDMI. Interesting.
Nope.
All the Dells that I bought recently have mini display ports.
So that's something.
I actually like that as a connector.
Because the step from mini display port to Thunderbolt is not very far.
Yeah, it's the same cable. It's not the same cable. It's the same port thing.
Right.
You can stick a mini DP monitor cable into your Thunderbolt port and it will just work.
Right. So I don't know. Maybe there is some hope. How did we get on USB?
Yeah, I don't know. I blame John.
Let's change it back. Let's change it back to the subject, back to something related to the Maker Faire. This is subject. Arduino do.
Oh, yeah. Talk to me about
but the it's Dewey. Not pronounced do. No, it's Dewey. And once again, guys, come on, guys. Spell it like it sounds.
They're Italian. What do you expect?
Oh, man. Just stop. Arduino, unpronounceable the very first time you see it. Like, Arduino, right? And now it's called Dewey. And like, okay, you could have just put a W in there and an EY, and then it would have been Dewey.
And then it would have defeated Truman.
Then I wouldn't be able to rant.
That's true too. Oh well.
So this, I'm of, and I only bring this up because this was a big thing at the fair. There was a lot of people that were excited about seeing this board. They had a big long talk about it that I actually sat through the video. It's 1 hour long, talking about all the things that they hope to accomplish from this ARM-based project.
Right.
And my first thought after looking at it was like, hey, that's really cool. And my second thought was, wow, did you guys jump the shark or what?
So why is that? I'm actually not super familiar with it. They seem to not have as large a presence in the New York fair.
Considering that the product touches like everything, you know, everybody who's learning to most of the 3D printer stuff has some component of it that's an Arduino, not the small one, but the bigger ones. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of people are learning from it. And so it's a very powerful learning tool for learning about electronics and programming. And that's the original one is not my beef. It's this new one that I've decided I'm going to have issues with.
I'm interested in hearing your side too, but I also have some background on that too, because one of the things, like for instance, in our electronics shop, we talk about this all the time. Our primary electronics engineer, he's always, everybody keeps bringing in, wondering, can I do this on Arduino? And I have to tell them, no, it's not fast enough. Can't sample fast enough, you know. But if it were slightly more powerful, if it were, say, an ARM in there, you could do it. So I think part of that is just recognizing that there's only so far they can really go with the,
sure, you know, with the platform. Well, I think that they're doing themselves a disservice by calling this new thing, you know, it's basically a new processor, a new amount of RAM, another size board. It introduces a lot of things and it carries a lot of problems forward. The fact that the people on the forum are saying, geez, guys, why did you decide to make this decision about shields? You know,
yeah, I don't understand that. Because how hard is it to make new shields?
And specifically, it's the 5 volts issue, right? And they're like, come on, can you just support 5 volts? And they're like, no. Which is bizarre, right? And how hard is it to make new shields? Well, the thing is, it's not hard at all if you rename it, right? If you call it R3no, right? You give it a new name and say, here's our new mega platform. Not mega, because there's an Arduino mega. But the idea is that you go in a new direction and it's another path, and it basically like gives you the Apple III or the Macintosh option, right?
Right. The Macintosh from the new Apple II. Yeah.
But
right.
But their problem is that Arduino is the product and also the name of the company. So
yeah. Well, but they should have seen this coming, right? They should have. I mean, this is classic. This is the classic problem that every other company has that's done that, you know, that they have their main product named after the same thing. And and there's nothing protectable about it because the name is open source and there's, you know, everyone uses it. So I don't know how they're going to enforce a TM or any of that in the future.
Yeah, they really could have done more to differentiate it somehow. I don't know if I have the answer, but I agree because it's, when you look at it, it looks like, okay, this is another Arduino with a different name and it's got some more headers on it. But it must be the same thing, right? And it's totally not.
Well, I mean,
no. This is my other problem with it is that if you look at the original project, you could take the chip off, the Atmel chip, and plug it into a breadboard or to your final circuit, and it's programmed and ready to go. And then you can continue to use your development board for another thing. Put another 328, Atmel 328 in it, and you're good to go on your development way. But it seems to me that they'd rather sell those blue boards than to do that, which is reinforced by the fact that the chip that's on the new board can't be easily replaced. I can't take that chip off and put it into my project board and call it a day. I don't have that flexibility. I'm going to have to carry that gigantic thing around in my project from place to place. And it, okay, sure, that's good for marketing, that's good for awareness, that's good for all that stuff, but it doesn't help me make my product go if that's my thing.
Well, if that boards your thing. I mean, but there isn't the equivalent chip that's, you know, that's pinnable. I mean, and you can still get an Uno and do what you're talking about doing. So I don't know.
I'm just saying that from the spirit of the board, this is a departure that I think is a huge mistake. The other problem is that a lot of people, especially students, have this idea that bigger is bigger and that bigger is better, and that you should always learn the bigger thing because there's nothing to learn from that old thing. And in the case of Arduino, there's everything to learn from that, from the original concept. and we don't have to run away from that so quickly. And as long as there's bigger, badder, more expensive, then kids and people and teachers are going to look at that and go, well, obviously this one's better because it's $50, not $30.
But it's an entirely separate platform that doesn't allow for as many options.
Well, it allows for whatever options that people come up with. I mean, the things where we run into walls, right? With what Maggie was talking about with processor speed and not having enough digital or analog lines or any of that. Those are the things that are real problems for people who are doing bigger projects. But that doesn't mean that the project should share the same name.
Right, right.
Yeah, I guess just playing devil's advocate, though, it's like the Uno is, you know, still there. You can still buy it. They're still producing.
Sure.
So, I don't know.
I just think that I think the story is going to get confused over time. And especially with all the other people, all the other manufacturers that have made boards that are very similar to this, to solve a lot of the problems that the people are complaining about.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of it too.
Well, that is an interesting thing because, you know, they're calling it the Due, and that's two, right? So it's the natural progression from the one. And so therefore, this is the new platform now. And so, yeah, the idea that there is now a money message because you can still buy the Uno and you can still do all the stuff that you could on the Uno. And there's a lot of value still in that. But if you do need a larger project, it's, you know, you've got this. But if someone's new coming to the whole Arduino game, they're taking a look at it and they will probably almost be blind.
They're going to look at it and they're going to go, oh, well, that's the next one, so I'll do that. Right. It's going to be just like the other one, but better. And, yeah, I do see
and
that.
Maybe the Uno is because it happens to be cheaper, is at a reduced cost because no one wants it anymore, and they're trying to push it out, you know, of inventory or something, you know, because that's how big companies normally work. Even though this is not that, people still have the perception that that's how that's going to work.
We'll see how it shakes out. It may be a non-problem. It may be that people are bright enough to figure this out.
Right. The people that use it might.
My experience with technology over the last however long I've been in it has always been that people want the one with the bigger number.
Sure. Sure. It's kind of human nature. You know, they equate value with quantity. And so two is bigger than one.
Right. But when you're talking about consumers or you're talking about makers, they're kind of different people. So yeah, it is hard to say.
True.
Another, and the same sort of thing, I don't know if you'll be following the fact that the new MakerBot Replicator 2 is not open hardware anymore.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That causes a huge rift, and for good reason. A lot of the things that MakerBot Industry, which is the name of the company, learned was from the open source community. And by participating in those trials and things. And everybody was really, 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 really open about their mistakes and their successes.
Right. And they were a huge advocate for it. You know, you would go to their site and they would be pushing, this is why it's great for everyone, you know. And then now it's, you know, it's kind of, I mean, I see the decisions as a company. I see those and understand it a bit. But it's still kind of like it gets on your skin a little bit. I mean, there was the whole thing with the Tangibot, which was someone had a Kickstarter. Basically, it was an exact replica of the Replicator 1 made in China, about for like 2/3 of the price. you know, and a lot of people got up in arms like that, but it's like, well, it is open hardware, so that's technically okay, but it got under people's skin. And I think this kind of gets under my skin a little bit too, because MakerBot Industries were such huge advocates of, you know, if you can't open it, you don't own it.
Well, they Googled it. They Googled, right? They basically took the idea of open source and said, not anymore. They kind of went back on their word.
In a way. You know, they never said they wouldn't ever do it.
I don't think that there ever was that promise.
Right.
You know, that's the thing with open source, and a lot of the nerds about this forget that open, and especially that one guy, that open source can be a commercial project, that it can have elements of it that are not for the public, that just are never going to work. And this was the thing, you know, having come at it from the other side, having developed products, we've run into the GPL and I'm like, oh, geez, the GPL. Ugh. Right. Well, there's ways around that, right? You can drop a breadcrumb and have the thing pick it up on the other side. You can have an API into it that you make the API public, but you don't make what's inside the API public. There's other ways around having your product touch this that don't violate those things. And IBM and Oracle and Sun and everybody has this as something that they go up against every day. Yeah. And those companies are big and they're contributing to those things and they contribute back. I think that, you know, if you want to look at the biggest violator of open sourceness, it's Apple Computer. They've been very slow lately to give back parts of WebKit back into the community. And there's some turmoil about that, but, you know, eventually those things will get resolved.
Yeah.
And they'll go, here's our stuff.
Yeah, I think it'll all shake out. I mean, and I was at the Somerville Maker Faire, and I was totally, you know, showing, here's the, you know, the Replicator 2, and I think it's great and everything. And, and I would have to mention to certain people who I could tell were more nerdy than others, you know, well, you know, it's not open hardware anymore, and they've just released this Makerware, which is also not open source, and yes, it has Qt, but my understanding is they paid Qt a license for it so that they can close it. So it's a very different vibe coming from MakerBot Industries. But like you say, on the flip side, from a company perspective, I totally do understand.
Well, and also, you know,
I don't like it, but
well, also on from a user perspective, how much of that really matters in the end? If as long as I get to use the hardware in the way that I would like to use it. And if I have possession of it, I'm going to do it, license be damned, then it really doesn't matter. But
it's kind of like a breakup, though, because like they had their big farewell, basically their farewell speech, their breakup speech recently. Right. And it was like, you know, we're not going to be a part of you anymore, really.
It's the end of an era, certainly. But I think it's all, you know, it's all sound and fury signifying nothing as long as the user is able to use.
Well, and there are other things out there.
There's a departure, though. The thing is that you know, they took an investment of, what was it, $2 million? There's a bunch of people that work for that company now, and they're on the road to making printers that people can do real work with. And so in order to do that, there has to be some closedness to that. And here's the other thing, if you really want the features of the new MakerBot, the Replicator, then buy one and look at how the extruder works and replicate it.
Or take the Replicator 1 and, you know, make it better.
Right, enhance
which is basically what the Replicator 2 is, because the Replicator 1 is still open, so.
Yeah, and so, you know, you can go and look at all the things that people are doing in the open for extruders and for stepper motor controllers and for builds and that, and you can say, well, okay, this is actually more suited for the kind of things that I want to do.
Or, you know, like some people, I guess you could just sit in a corner and be a purist and sulk about how everyone sold out.
Yeah, exactly.
It used to be about the music.
Yeah. I mean, you know, do you want to print something or do you want to make printers? That's really the question. You know, do you want to fiddle with trying to make to get your extruder to work or do you want to print stuff? You know, you want to print toys for your dog. I guess it depends on the goal of the person and that and the level of purist that you want to be.
Right. But because in the end, all these other kits are out there waiting for you to, you know, play with them.
Exactly. And my thing, you know, my thing is about a 3D printer, and I'm, you know, it's on my, my list of projects is to actually build one of these. And I kind of don't care which version it is. You know, I know that there's a new version of the Prusa, and I know that there's four different versions that are not based on screws that are based on other things. And I look at that, I'm like, okay, well, those are interesting, but I'm going to learn, where am I going to learn the most?
Yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's, yeah, the different motivation.
Right. And for me, I'm looking for end product. I'm looking for, you know, what is the quality level? What's the resolution of the product that comes out of the printer itself?
Right. So a replicator 2 might be right up your alley. Exactly. It fits in your price point. Or the Form Labs Form 1, mm-hmm. which I actually, ooh. I had, yeah, they came, I contacted them right before the fair. They brought me some sample parts, and let me tell you, they were beautiful.
Cool.
I mean, rosin has its issues. It does get brittle over time and whatnot, but they brought me a chess piece. It's the, I don't know if you saw it. It's the, it was hollow, and inside it had stairs going around the, what is, was it a no, what's the one on the end? It looks like a castle's turret.
Oh, a rook.
Yeah, rook. Sorry, I'm blanking.
It's a good thing
here.
It's, you know,
the castle.
The castle.
My horse got your castle.
Exactly. So yeah, so it was a rook, and it had, you know, it had stairs running around in a, you know, in a helix around the interior. It was beautiful.
Ah, that's pretty cool. Yeah, I may need one of those.
And it looks like, judging from their Kickstarter prices for the Form 1, it looks like they're probably going to sell them for around $2,500 for a UV stereolithography rosin printer. That is just amazing.
Yeah. I mean, that's an order of magnitude and then some less than what it was, you know, a couple of years ago or even earlier this year, you know?
Yeah. And some guy stopped by my table and he was talking about his company. Yeah, we had one of this thing. It was huge and it cost like $100,000. And it's like, wow.
Yeah. Well, that's like all this stuff, right? It used to cost $100,000. Yeah. Now it costs $1,500 and people are like, oh, that's too expensive. Like, are you kidding me? Like,
exactly.
And it's everything. It's you know, it's everything from the laser printer to the paper cutter to the t-shirt printer thing to the automatic lathe and the CNC machine. And, you know, there's all these machines that all cost $1,500.
The thing is, too, with the machines, I mean, even the price isn't, it shouldn't be an excuse for anyone, because there's all the hacker spaces, there's the tech shop and all that. So, I mean, if you really want to do this stuff.
Well, that's what I was going to bring up as well, which is, you know, there are these wonderful hacker spaces coming up in all the major metropolitan areas. There's one in New York. There's one in Somerville. There are several in the San Francisco Bay Area. I think there's one in Seattle as well. But they just seem to be cropping up everywhere. And what a fantastic place, you know, because not everyone can afford their own laser cutter, their own CNC machine, their own autolathe. They're all, you know, all that stuff. But, you know, they can pay a few bucks a month, you know, to have access to it and to take classes in order to use them properly. I mean, that's brilliant.
Yeah. The place I'm at, the Artisans Asylum here, I mean, it's exactly like that. You can just take classes if you want. You can get a membership. You don't have to rent space, or you can also rent space there. We have CNC, laser cutters, huge, like, industrial-sized routers. We have a full welding shop. So stuff is, it's just, it's out there. It's just amazing to me that there are enough people to support this, but there are.
Yeah, they come out of the woodwork and everything. It's because it's time now. You know, it's time for people to start making physical things again. You know, because I think for a while we kind of, or at least people of a certain background, lost that desire for a while because we were busy watching television.
Well, we went into a period too where people could manufacture for us at what was then a cheaper price things that we wanted, and that's still true now, but we're also entering this phase where we can control the manufacturing, like John's designing PCB boards for his electronics product and sends them off over the internet. They're printed, sent back to him, you know.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and we've had that service for a long, long time. You know, overnight circuit boards has existed in in one form or another for the last 25 years. But the thing that the differentiator is that it used to be that that was a $500 proposition.
Yeah.
And now it's a, you know, $40 proposition. And you might have to wait 2 weeks, but who cares?
Yeah, it's 2 weeks. Yeah, yeah, big deal.
Because they've got a bunch of people that'll line up a bunch of jobs and just blast through them. So there are enough people to bring the cost down. It's amazing.
Well, it's to the point where we're starting to get ideas, and those ideas can be made manifest, where we can say, oh, you know, we also used to sketch stuff on napkins or in notebooks or whatever, saying like, you know, I'd like to design this thing, you know, this car or this whatever. And now we have the opportunity to actually make it real if we want to. And we can make it real by ourselves, basically. We could hang out in the hackerspaces. We can learn how to weld. We can create giant, multi-legged, articulated robots, machines, or what have you. We can do all that ourselves. We don't have to just be satisfied with drawing them on paper.
Yep. There are a lot of people who are starting to catch on to that. I mean, going back to the Artist's Asylum, it started out with one building with a few thousand square feet. And then it grew to, you know, 25,000 square feet, and it's growing again. And it's just, it's enormous here in Somerville, you know, Massachusetts. Not, you know, we're not in LA or somewhere, and this place is huge.
I just want to know what everybody's projects are right now.
Oh,
I
mean,
Because we've talked about, you know, we've talked about making, and I think it's unfair that we talk about making, but we don't talk about what we're making.
Right.
John, what are you making?
So, projects are interesting because I have a lot of projects going on, and projects can be in different states, and you can have multiple ones going on at the same time, and I think it's a healthy thing to do, because otherwise what happens is that you kind of, I don't know, I always feel like I get to a point on a project and I'm stuck because I have a need for parts, or I have I don't have a skill, or I may not have time.
Right, or there's some amount of tedium that you can't always put yourself into that you can come back to later.
Like soldering 100 LEDs onto a board, or in this case, not LEDs, but diodes. You know, it's like you can only do that for so, it's not even that big of a task. It's probably like 40 minutes or so, but you got to test each one and make sure that they're good and on. So there's those kind of things. So I don't know. I have a list of the various stages of the project, and we'll throw those in the notes, I guess.
Can you task rabbit that?
What?
Soldering a whole bunch of diodes.
Well, yeah, in San Francisco, that would be totally doable. Although I would just post a thing on Dorkbot and make somebody on Dorkbot do it.
Oh, brilliant! I haven't even been hip to Dorkbot. I'm now going to be very hip to Dorkbot.
Yeah, Okay, so Dorkbot to sideways is an organization which is people doing interesting things with electricity. And
I know some of those people. Oh, sorry, never mind. That's a different show.
And lots of people. Oh, there's a Dorkbot in practically everywhere. There's one in Austin, and there's one in San Francisco that's really active. I'm sure there's one in Boston. But you know, go to dorkbot.net. org.com, whatever. Go to Dorkbot.
Org, I think.
Yeah. And
org.
Org. And you'll find your Dorkbot there. And anyway, it's one of the best parts about Dorkbot is the mailing list. They have the announce one, and then they have the blabber one. And the blabber one is like where all the interesting jobs come up, and who's getting rid of a lathe, and somebody's got a box of something that they don't want anymore. Anyway, all that stuff is there. And yeah, so I would probably put my task rabbit of hooking up all this stuff to the dorks and let them do it.
Right on. Yeah, so that's really cool. I've pulled up the site now, and it's really quite wild.
Yeah. So I have two projects that I want to talk about. One of them is my Raspberry Pi project, which was inspired by the fact that one of the founders was touring hackerspaces around the country. And so he was going to be in San Francisco on the 29th. And the first time I got the wrong 29th, there was two Saturdays in a month where there was a 29th on a Saturday. don't. So I got the wrong Saturday. Anyway, I started this project of converting a old Mac Classic into something that would that had a Raspberry Pi in it.
Neat.
Yeah. And I've learned a ton from it about the Pi and about the some manufacturing stuff and that. And I painted the case black and I put a Raspberry on the back or the Raspberry Pi logo on the back. And
That's what the painting was about.
That's what the painting is about. Yes. No, I haven't really let on what this project is. And everybody's like, he's doing something with the Raspberry Pi and I don't know what it is.
Right. We're putting it inside an old Mac Classic.
Yeah. So it works. I had to put a different VGA monitor into the case because the old one was not to spec and the Pi was never going to talk to it. So I removed all of the high voltage from the power supply and put the new high voltage in and got it to work. So anyway, it's at a V1 stage where it's essentially done and working and that and show offable. Oh, here's the nerd part of this. All the connectors for the peripherals go into the original sockets. And so there's a mouse that I an original Mac mouse that I remade with an optical USB, but it still uses the 4-pin thing. And then I used a Teensy, which is a Arduino thing. And this is like a really cool project, the Teensys. We'll get into those.
I love the Teensy.
The Teensy is way better, I think, than the Arduino in terms of its support and the projects and the things that are there. And it's cheap. Oh my gosh, this guy, he's a guy of one and he's making these things. He's making a living off this, you know, selling these things. Anyway, the Teensy. So I made it so the Teensy talks to an ADB keyboard in its original state. So you don't have to, I didn't have to rewire.
Nice. <That's awesome. laughs>
So you plug these Mac peripherals into this. To this Pi and it works. It was pretty cool.
So do you plug in your Apple extended keyboard too?
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, I have one of those. Right, it's right here.
We should mention that the Teensy, the name is literal. It's about the size of 2/3 of a stick of gum.
Oh, it's awesome. It's tiny. It's the same. Here's the thing. It's smaller than a 27256.
That's what I've used them on a couple of things where you like you throw it in something and you don't care about leaving it in there, you know?
Yeah, it's just
like you were talking about. Yeah,
it's just going to live there forever, and that's kind of cool.
There's a new similar thing called a DigiSpark that was just kickstarted. Which I've got some coming on that. It's so basically it's a board, but it's like one side of the board is just the USB plug. It's pretty awesome.
Neat.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. So and then that. Project is nearly done. That's why I needed to make the circuit board because it's 8.5 inches wide, and so that's way longer than 100 centimeters. the project number two is actually a tour of project boards. So I have all these project boards. I've got the TI-430, the new Strela project. I've got the ST Discovery. I've got a Teensy, and I've got a Arduino, and I decided that I wanted to make a MIDI keyboard. Well, I could have just bought one and been done with it, but I decided that I didn't want to go that way. So I found a keyboard that was $10 and it basically had no guts in it. And it was just keys and somebody was going to throw it away. And I'm like, no, send that to me. And so it turns out it has a matrix on it already. And I figured out the map of the matrix. And then I've hooked up some hardware to it so that you can detect keys. They're going up and down. And then it'll fling that out to MIDI. So it turns out that the Arduino has got the best tool chain for talking to MIDI overall, although it doesn't have enough pins it doesn't have enough pins to talk to my keyboard. So it's all about matrixing them now, which is fine.
Wild.
Yeah. Yeah, wild. It's like, dude, just go buy a Casio keyboard and be done with it.
set it on demo and be done with it.
Yeah, but that's no fun.
Exactly. That's not the point. No. The point is that, you know, and part of the journey is the reward, and that's really the bottom line of it. And You know, if it's one thing to pick it up at the store and then take it home and set it there and look at it and go, well, shit, I don't know how to play. Right. And then you have that frustration. But it's different when you're putting your hands on it and you're making it and you have the incentive to say, yeah, I want to play my instrument.
Yeah. And when people come over and they go, what's that? You go, I built that.
That's fine. Yeah. I made that keyboard from trash. And I have other projects that I'm doing. It's so much fun when you get in this mode of project, all the other things that it you stir up, like, oh, I should think about that. And so I'm not going to do that project for 6 months, but I'm going to think about it for 6 months. You know, in the back of my head, on the bus, while I'm waking up in that, you know, space between awake and asleep where you can get a lot of stuff done. You know, those are the kind of things I want to have in my head.
I do a lot of that. I do a lot of pre-planning. I may not actually touch anything for a year or two, but I've been planning it out and thinking about it and going through all the motions, virtually in my brain, so that when I do finally have the time to devote to it, it becomes production versus all the other bits all at once. I'm working on a couple of projects. I make a lot of virtual things. I'm doing this one hybrid now, and this is actually based on something I found at the Maker Fair, which is this Piled. It's now a Kickstarter project. It's the programmable intelligent LED development environment, and it's meant to be an educational tool, but the end result is that it can control a bank of RGB LEDs so that you can control the hue, you can control the intensity, and it also has Bluetooth as well. Not only am I in the process of getting the hardware all settled, but I'm also creating an iOS app to control it remotely, which would be a lot of fun, because I figure if I can get it done via Bluetooth, I can probably modify the board to accept wireless so it can be on the network. And if it's on the network, then I can change the light from wherever, or I can have it triggered from whatever. So if I'm at a party or whatever, I can have it triggering all sorts of different strobe combinations or color combinations or what have you.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting that it had Bluetooth on the board. That was a very interesting decision.
Yeah, I thought that made all the difference in the world, because who wants to fiddle with the actual bit of hardware once it's all hooked up? So the board will hook up to LED tape, which is, you know, you've got a bunch of LEDs in tape form, and you can cut them off, and they usually you have to cut them off in like sets of three or sets of six or what have you. They come in spools. Normally when you see LEDs, like in Radio Shack or wherever, you know, you see the single LED with the leads on it. This is really just an adhesive-backed LED strip. You know, you can wrap it around a pole, right. You can, you know, trace it around, you know, a rectangle. And one of the kits that, or part of the kit in the Kickstarter campaign that this guy's doing, he's making light panels. And if you are in the videography universe, you're probably familiar with what a light panel is, which is basically an array of white LEDs set to a particular color temperature that will give you really nice, very low power, but a lot of lumens light on your subject. And unfortunately, they're a 1x1, so like a 12-inch by 12-inch square will run you a huge amount of money. They used to be $1,000. I think they're a little bit cheaper now, but they have a patent on it. And so the cheaper ones coming out from other places are potentially being thrown off the market because of this patent problem. But if you can make your own...
Yeah, there's actually a petition about that going around.
Yeah, it's a little bit intense right now. But if you make your own, and this is really cool because here it is, you know, you're making it for like $50 as opposed to $1,000. You know, you're making it yourself, which is kind of cool because you're learning how to do this and what it all is involved. But also, there are RGB lights, so you have the opportunity to create keys and fills in any color that you desire. You know, if I can control one of these devices through my iPhone or through an Android phone or what have you, some sort of remote, I can control a bank of them, and I can control them as a group. So, for example, if I have a key light at 50%, I have another key at 20%, and I have a fill at 40% or in different areas, I can move those up and down relatively, you know, so they all maintain the difference between between the lights. And I think that's really fascinating. So that's kind of the part that I'm concentrating the most on right now. It's going to take a while.
Yeah. As you guys can hear, we discovered in the last episode that Christopher was a lighting designer in a previous life.
Yeah.
That's what explains why he's so happy about this. I'm super excited.
Well, because, you know, the thing that separates good filming, videography, what have you, from bad is sound and light. You know, a lot of people can frame a shot pretty well. It doesn't really matter what camera you've got. But if the lighting is bad and if the audio is bad, it looks very amateur. And here's yet another very accessible thing that will help up the game. And that's a good thing.
Yes, totally agree. I'm sure Kristen does too.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Kristen, what are you making these days?
Well, I feel like that my stuff is rather pedestrian in comparison. I'm just right now, you know, I'm pretty busy at work with projects that I can't talk about either. But as far as on the home front, I'm working on expanding my Halloween display with new articulated spiders and all the latest LED lighting.
Cool.
There is nothing wrong with that. I'm a huge Halloweeny.
I have boxes and boxes of Halloween stuff, and I, every time I'm out and about, I have to find new stuff to add in. Nice. And so.
Let's see if we can do awesome. Bluetooth activated semi-autonomous articulated spiders.
That would be awesome. That would be awesome. It would drive my dogs crazy, but
yeah, but you know, whatevs. You know, whatever works for them, you know. It's the barking and the howling will merely enhance the mood.
It'll just add to the whole overall ambiance, yeah.
Yes. Cool. Yes.
I love Halloween. I guess that's a segue into one of the things I'm working on too. Is I just ordered a bunch of RGB LEDs that have a chip built in so that they just cycle.
Oh, yep.
So I'm gonna for Halloween. I'm building some small LED light sources for like pumpkins.
Oh yeah, that's perfect.
That's a little thing though. But the bigger thing I'm working on. Well, I just finished the arc reactor. The bigger thing I'm working on.
No, an actual arc reactor.
Yeah, right. One kid asked me at the fair, does it really work? Like,
shall we test it out? No.
Yes, it does.
Hold on to this cable.
I'm glad you asked.
Here, lick this.
This will only hurt for a microsecond. Yes. The other thing I'm working on is I'm working on a couple of props. I don't know if one of them will get used. I don't know if you know, if you've ever seen the Star Wars fan film, Pink Five.
Oh, yeah.
Trey Stokes. Yeah, they're doing a fifth one. And I mentioned to him that I was interested in doing a prop. And I don't know if he'll, you know, if he'll use it or not. But I've decided I'm just going to build it anyway. Because I've never built anything that's in the Star Wars universe. So it's basically, the blinky hand prop. So I'm using some of the smaller LCD panels from Adafruit. And some other bits and pieces on that. So that's I'm working on trying to figure out what that's going to look like, and then what'll go in it. And then I don't know if anybody who follows me on Twitter knows I'm obsessed with the Aquabats.
Yes, you are.
So I'm building a prop from the show that I just wanted to build. They had this a very simple prop on there, but I wanted, you know, it was like a ghost finder thing. But I wanted to build one with an actual display and stuff, so I'm working on that. But those are the only things I'm really seriously concentrating on at the moment. I have, like John said, I have a bunch of stuff in the back burner, some EL wire and EL tape stuff. And
What I was intrigued by that was went by in your Twitter feed a while back was the Space 1999 stuff, like a comm lock. Where did that land?
So, I don't know. So the Eagle's done. I guess you've seen that. That's been a while back. In fact, that has a teensy in it, John. That's what runs the lights. But
we totally need to make a small film, short film involving the Eagle. We need to make that happen.
I keep looking at it, wanting to film it and to do something. Yeah,
I've got enough wide angle lenses that we can make that happen.
So I have mocked up the comm lock in plastic just to work out. And one of the displays I have, it's an LCD display that will fit. But And in fact, I've got on my bench, there's another Teensy that's been sitting there with this display hooked to it forever. Like John said, I'm sitting there and I'm thinking about it in the back of my mind. So that it kind of works, but there's some of the stuff I haven't figured out how I want to do it. Like, you know, with the keypad and things like that. But yeah, that's going forward. I'm slowly working on that. It's the Adam Savage thing. You know, you have like 20 things in the fire, but some of them aren't burning very hot. You know,
they're all remaining warm.
Yep. Speaking of which, and speaking of makers, if anyone's not seen it, Adam Savage, they do this show where they go to his quote unquote man cave and show
most unfortunate name.
I think I've seen that film. Oh no, wait.
No. That's a different one.
Yeah, I can't remember the name of the show. Oh, it's Tested. Yeah, if you go to tested.com. Yeah, it's awesome though, because he's always working on something. He's done a full size Iron Man outfit. He did the Rocketeer for Comic Con. He did a full Rocketeer pack and the whole thing. And he's been working on this Rasputin's glove from Hellboy. That's one of those things that's like we were talking about earlier with John. Like, you know, it has all the tedious stuff. So he says he puts it aside and then he'll work on it and he'll put it aside. But it's really awesome to look at all the stuff he's working on. He's just amazing.
Practicals are way better than CGI.
Yeah, I think we've had this discussion before.
Just always and forever.
We can't have it enough because
it remains true and it cannot be reinforced enough. It's crazy.
It depends on the practical.
I suppose, but still, practicals always over CGI.
They have a special place in our hearts.
Yeah. A friend of mine, actually, you know, we're talking about, you know, kind of bodging together stuff to make cool things that are also, I mean, they can be whimsical, you know, like, you know, Space 1999 stuff. But some of it's useful and practical for the other version of the other definition of the term. A friend of mine, whom I know via Live Journal from a billion years ago, we've met a couple of times. He's a biker. He lives in Southern California. Every year he goes on a run to Badger Flat. And one of the things that he does is he brings, well, for a while he was trying to figure out, well, it's dark there at night, go figure. There's no electricity. There's no running water. There's no nothing. It's everything you bring up with you. So a lot of people late at night, you know, they have trouble stumbling from their tents or wherever to find a place to pee and do their business and get back. And so what he did was he started creating these little trail lights via LEDs and button batteries. So which were sort of taken from the idea of the, you guys ever heard of the throwies?
The throwies, right, exactly. Yeah.
And so he took that idea and made these trail lights. And so now they were a huge hit. Everyone really loved them. What he would do is also he'd take the throwies, but he'd also do two things. Because there's a lot of dew in the morning and all that sort of thing, or sometimes it's just plain straight up raining, he'll put plastic over them so they're protected overnight. And the battery, the button battery, will actually last a good, you know, 12, 24 hours, you know, which is really nice, which is perfect for the amount of time that the run is. And what he'll also do is also put a keg cup over it, which also helps to diffuse the light. And of course, if you get the red ones, they don't screw up your night vision either. And so now what he's doing is he's found an attachment that you can plug an LED into and a battery that allows you to use a plastic water bottle or a soda bottle as basically a lantern. And so you put like liquid into it, like water or what have you, and the light shines down into the liquid, diffusing the light a bit, so you get a little bit of ambient, you know, nice diffuse light. But he was thinking about stepping it up a bit and turning it into a bit of a colloid and having...
I was about to say, right now John is sitting here thinking, what other liquids could I put into this bottle?
So
if you put bleach in it, it'll make it really bright.
Right, yeah. I was saying it'll be really blue.
No, just normal bleach, and it'll bring the luminosity of the water up by a factor of three.
Oh, wow. Cool. Good to know. Good to know. He was experimenting with colloids and specifically like glitter, like suspending glitter in the colloid, which would be really, really cool.
But but everybody's got some barrier, right? Oh, I don't have the skill set. All right, take a class. Oh, I don't have the tool. Then go buy the tool, right? This is a crazy thing. So this is my reinvigoration of making, and that was back in June. The people at tech shop were having a sale, and they're like, you know what? This is the last time we're going to have the $99 a month sale, and from here on, the price is going to go to here. So, you know, pay up now or don't. And I thought about it and I said, what would I do with $100? Just $100. If I had that money, instead of paying it to Tech Shop, just so that I can go there and use all these awesome tools, what if I use that as a budget for doing weird stuff? You know, like, you know, having a budget to buy parts, having a budget to get something crazy from eBay, getting whatever I need to do. So I take the barrier of money away from that. And so that's what I did. And I'm having a good time with it. Instead of joining Tech Shop.
Right. Awesome. So, Kristen, John, it was a pleasure having you. I'm so glad you could make it, A, on such short notice, but B, it's just always a pleasure hanging out with you guys. So thank you very much. Kristen, where can we find you?
Twitter. I've been more frequent.
Yay.
a more frequent poster since our last conversation. Kristen C. Martin.
Excellent.
And and of course, still toiling away in a post-production land.
Right on. So, John, where can we find you?
So I have this crazy podcast called No Tech, and it's been on hiatus, although the people still love us for far too long. And Kristen and I have made a bunch of shows lately, months ago. It seems like yesterday. And I owe it to the world to get those out. And so
I was on a few of those.
You do.
So anyway, that's notech.tv. You can find it on iTunes and on the website.
K-N-O-W.
Yeah, K, not N-O-W, or that would be Now Tech, but... and the hilarious thing is, I there's a short story about this. Is I sent a information request in for somebody, and they thought that I was on Tech TV. And I'm like, wow, where did you get Tech TV? Oh, right here. Right. See, that's the end part. You didn't even bother to read the first part, and that was kind of the joke of the whole show name is that. You know, it's No Tech TV because none of the people that are on the show have been on that show. anyway, so you can find me. I'm on Twitter at John Foster, and I actually reply to stuff, and it's kind of fun.
Right on. And so, Maggie, where can we find you?
You can also find me on Twitter at TANKGRRL or on the web at about.me/MaggieMcPhee. And where can we find you, Sir Octothorpe?
Well, indeed, you can find me on the Twitters at Octothorpe. And you can also find me, well, barely these days. Although I swear to God, I'm going to make additional updates. And you can find me at localtype.org. And you can also find me... Where else can you find me these days?
RI4E.com.
That is true. You can find us all at ruinitforeveryone.tv or RI4E, and that's the numeral 4.com. Thank you all again, and have a lovely, lovely making time. That was another episode of Ruining It for Everyone with your hosts Maggie McPhee and Christopher Harrington. Music provided by Kevin MacLeod. You can find us at ruinitforeveryone.tv. or search for Ruining It for Everyone on iTunes. Be sure to subscribe and rate the show as it really helps us out. All right, excellent. That, or something like that. We can...
Rhode Island! traveling for me.
Yes. So you realize that we have to call this Shake Your Maker Fair, right?
If you insist.
Yeah, because, yeah. Right on.
Oh, well, you know what? We never introduced who was on the show.
Right.
That's okay. Okay. It's the normal way.
Yeah. Well, also, I in the header I say who's in it anyway.
Oh yeah, that's right. I keep forgetting we do that. We haven't done this in a long time.
Yeah.
So far we have learned always Major Dickinson and Stand by the Unicorn.
Yes. Who was apparently named Katy Perry, by the way, which I think is hilarious.
This podcast will have lessons.
Yes. Important life lessons for you and your loved ones.
Come on, I had to build an arc reactor. Give me a break.
And that, I have to say, the picture that you showed on Twitter was brilliant. It looked so cool. Did you implant it into your chest?
I haven't. Yeah. I'm a little scared of the
working
whole
on it. Working on it.
A little scared of that nuclear fission thing.
Well, it's getting the little post hole diggers and pulling my heart out that kind of have given me the creeps.
It's kind of a deal breaker right there, yeah.
Yeah. And I don't have those fantastic robots to save me if I start to go, you know.
Oh, see, clearly you are not working for the right college.